WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. And welcome to this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for the best hour of your life. That is, the one that's always in front of you, right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. This show is going to cover an important topic that we haven't focused on in quite some time, and that is nuclear power. Since our guest has so much to share with us about this issue, I'm going to introduce him without further delay. His name is Carl Grossman, and he's going to be able to give us a unique firsthand historical perspective on nuclear power, and unbeknownst to younger people, how it almost came to Long Island in a very, very big way. Carl is a full professor of journalism at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury. He teaches courses including investigative reporting and environmental journalism, and also practices journalism, having been engaged in investigative reporting in a variety of media for more than 50 years. For 30 years, he's hosted the nationally aired TV program Enviro Close-Up, produced by the New York-based video production company Enviro Video. He's also written and presented TV documentaries for EnviroVideo. He's the author of 6 books, including Cover Up, What You Are Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, Power Crazy, and The Wrong Stuff, The Space Program's Nuclear Threat to Our Planet, and Weapons in Space. He's also received a slew of honors for journalism, has given numerous presentations in the U.S. and around the world, including at the U.N. in Geneva, and multiple times at the U.N. in New York, as well as twice to members of the British Parliament on the issue of space weapons. His pieces have appeared in publications way too voluminous to list, but ranging from the New York Times to USA Today, the Boston Globe, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Christian Science Monitor, Newsday, and many, many more. Carl Grossman, welcome to The Healthy Planet.
A pleasure to be with you, Bob.
Every so often on this show, I have a guest that I describe to our listeners as someone you may never have heard of, but who you would really want to thank if you only knew the work they've done on behalf of Long Island and the world. Carl, you're one of those figures. You've been involved in confronting the powers that be on Long Island when it comes to the environment and nuclear issues for many decades, going back to opposing Robert Moses's push, and most people don't even know that this happens, to put a 4-lane highway on Fire Island in the early 1960s. You were also actively speaking out as part of the effort to stop the Long Island Lighting Company's plan to build a whole slew of nuclear power plants on Long Island, and of course, to opposing the Shoreham nuclear power plants. So on behalf of those who are living with the benefits of your work, and that is all of us on Long Island, thank you.
Thank you.
So let's start our discussion about nuclear power by asking you to give us a history lesson about LILCO, the Long Island Lighting Company's plan all those years back to put 7 to 11 nuclear power plants on Long Island. And while you're doing that, describe the role that you played in the fight against that plan and take as much time as you need to describe this history.
Yeah, well, actually, how it all started, this scheme to build 7 to 11 nuclear power plants on Long Island, in the parlance of the nuclear promoters at the time, they wanted Long Island to become a nuclear park. And the origin of that, that plan involves what was to be a nuclear plant in the geographic center of New York City. In fact, the next time listeners would be from Long Island are on the Long Island Expressway, just before you enter the Queens Midtown Tunnel, you're on an overpass, look to the right, look to the north, and you'll see a bunch of smokestacks. And that's a center for Con Ed's power production. And what Con Ed, the utility in New York City, wanted to build, this goes way back, in the early 60s, was a nuclear power plant right there, just again, north of the LIE, just across the East River from Manhattan. It would be called Ravenswood One, again, in the geographic center of New York City. And some very early anti-nukers in the city opposed Ravenswood One, and they got a bill introduced in the city council in New York prohibiting the placement of any nuclear plant within the boundaries of New York City. That's caused Con Ed to say, forget it, we'll just stick with our Indian Point nuclear plants, which are in Buchanan, New York, 25 miles north of Times Square, but outside the boundary of New York City, and no Ravenswood One. In that vacuum of sorts came the Long Island Lighting Company, which was this dopey, poorly run utility on the brink of bankruptcy in the 30s and the 40s. I have a book on all this. It's called Power Crazy, titled Power Crazy, because Lilco wanted to build all these nuclear plants here on Long Island. And in this vacuum came the Long Island Lighting Company saying, well, if Con Ed can't build a nuclear plant in Ravenswood, we'll build a bunch of nuclear plants on Long Island and deal with the concerns being raised at that point that nuclear plants shouldn't be built in middle of cities. They should be put in low density areas in terms of population. Also, a big nuclear plant requires a lot of water as coolant, 1 million gallons a minute. So here, Long Island has a relatively lower population than New York City. And we got a lot of water, particularly the Long Island Sound, to be used as coolant. So that began the effort by Lilco to, first it was actually considering a plant in Lloyd Harbor in Huntington. Charlie Pierce, who was the chairman of Lilco, he lived in Lloyd Harbor. He thought nothing wrong with nuclear, so it would be in his neighborhood. But
wow.
Folks in Lloyd Harbor didn't like that. What was formed was the Lloyd Harbor Study Group. And they fought this planned nuke in Lloyd Harbor with their attorney, Irving Like, an important name here. And so Lilco moved east. It went to Shoreham. Went to Shoreham because a lot of Brookhaven National Laboratory scientists and engineers live in Shoreham on the North Shore and also in Bellport on the South Shore. And Lilco figured that we'll build this first nuclear plant then in Shoreham. It would be one of three in Shoreham. And we'd get support in Shoreham from the community. Now that this, let me insert here the tie-in between Brookhaven National Laboratory and Lilco. From the outset, Phyllis Vineyard, who was the wife of the director of Brookhaven Lab, George Vineyard, was on the board of Lilco. That's the start. Brookhaven Lab scientists formed an organization to push nuclear power on Long Island. And in the end, the chairman of and CEO of the Long Island Lighting Company was William Catacasinos, and he had been formerly the assistant director of Brookhaven Lab. Brookhaven Lab was started by the Atomic Energy Commission in 1947 to develop civilian uses of nuclear technology. Out of Brookhaven Lab's base, Upton, near Yaphank, they pushed nuclear from the outset. So it was essentially a veritable partnership between Brookhaven Lab and the Long Island Lighting Company. The battle went on for years in terms of cost. Cost, frankly, is one element here. One has to consider the loss of lives if there'd be an accident at that Shoreham nuclear plant. And it was constructed, and it went through a bout of low power, problem riddled, low power tests. And a great issue raised by Suffolk County was that if there'd be an accident at Shoreham, how would folks on Long Island evacuate? I mean, the only way out would be the Queens Midtown Tunnel and the bridges that, a lot of people on Long Island. Joe Caputo, incidentally, he at one point was the county controller. he said, well, and he was one of the few officials who remained pro-nuclear, pro-shore. He said, well, if it's in the winter and the Long Island Sound would freeze, we could just put on ice skates. And Joe Caputo said this, we'd all ice skate over to Connecticut. But there was this enormous battle, went on for year after year after year. And finally it ended with this fellow, Irving Like, very importantly. He was the attorney for Citizens to Replace Lilco, which was chaired by his brother-in-law, Murray Barbash. And let me just go back to the Fire Island fight. This was my first big story as a journalist on Long Island. I was working for the Babylon Town Leader. This is 1964. Robert Moses, this public works czar, so-called master builder, lived in Babylon. And though as the power broker, the very important book about Robert Moses relates, Moses had the media of New York City in his pocket. And on Long Island too, actually, Newsday and the Long Island Press, big Moses supporters. But the Babylon Leader, this little weekly in Babylon, had challenged this Babylon resident Moses for many years. And I got there, it was the first week, they told me to go to Fire Island, write a story about what a four lane highway would, down the length, the 35 mile length of Fire Island, this is what Moses wanted, would do to nature on Fire Island, the lovely communities, the most interesting communities on Fire Island. Never been there before. I was able to run into some, in journalism, you look for good sound bites, people who can talk well. Charles Collingwood, I interviewed him. Teddy White, who had written a series of books, The Making of a President or the President, depending on the election. Reginald Rose, a famous playwright, put my story together, and I got a call once it appeared in the Babylon Leader from Murray Barbash, who was a green developer on Long Island, very environmentally involved. And he said, we got to do something about this. And what Murray and Irv ultimately decided to do, because they figured they're not going to stop Moses on a state level. He ran for governor once, a disastrous loss. So how he amassed power was to have these commissions and authorities that he headed do all kinds of things. And he really had more power than most elected, almost all elected officials. So he couldn't stop him on a state level. So Murray and Irv figured we got to get the feds in here. So they pushed for created a citizen committee for a Fire Island National Seashore, using the power of the federal government to stop Moses on the state level. And ultimately it was 62 that I got the job and the Babylon Leader started fighting the Fire Island Road. In 64, President Lyndon Johnson signed the legislation which authorized a Fire Island National Seashore. And that was the end of the Fire Island Road. Jumping back now to Shoreham, in which Murray and Irv were also major leaders, they figured we're not gonna be able to stop Shoreham on a federal level. The US Nuclear Regulatory Commission always rubber stamps licenses for, as it did for Shoreham, operating a construction license for nuclear power plants. In fact, some people with us call the NRC the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Commission. Say the NRC stands for not really caring. So you're not gonna stop, they figured, and they were correct, Lilco on the federal level, but let's get the state involved. And what they pushed was a Long Island Power Authority with the right of eminent domain. You know, like when a government wants to widen a road and somebody won't sell, the government has the power of eminent domain. It could seize that person's property. So here the Long Island Power Act was passed in 1985, giving this new entity, which was to be formed, the Long Island Power Authority, the authority to eliminate Lilco as a corporate entity. The bad news here was that Irv was one of the people who wrote the bill, Long Island Power Act. And he in the bill provided for the acquisition of Lilco's stock, which was enormously undervalued because of Lilco's nuclear adventure or its assets. And the governor then, Mario Cuomo, felt that to go against Lilco's assets would be too upsetting to Wall Street, too much of a shock to Wall Street. So it ended up with acquiring the poles and the lines and the assets. And we've been stuck and will continue to be stuck instead of with a $1 billion bill, which is probably what the stock would have cost us. Now it's a $7.5 billion tab to stop Shoreham and essentially take over Lilco. Still better our dollars than our lives, because, I mean, this is not just a Long Island problem. It's not just a national problem, nuclear power. It's a global problem. And guess what kind of nuclear power plants existed at Fukushima? They were exactly what was built at Shoreham, GE, General Electric, Mark I nuclear power plants. And there was also a cluster of nuclear power plants, six, at Fukushima Daiichi. We would have even more, 7 to 11. So we could have ended up the way the poor people of Japan ended up, with those three of the six Fukushima plants exploding and major explosions, hydrogen explosions, spreading radioactivity far and wide in Japan. It could have been us. It could have been Long Island. So again, better our money, though it's a lot of money, than our lives.
It's just hard to believe that back at that time, they were willing to put a nuclear plant in New York City, next to this population center. They really must have been convinced about the fact that it was safe. And obviously they were wrong.
They were deluded. But again, as I say, it's an international issue. And I've had the occasion to go to Russia a number of times. I've been there 7 times speaking on nuclear issues, nuclear power plant issues. We'll talk about it later in the interview, use of nuclear in space, which the Soviet Union and Russia have been involved, and we, the United States, have been involved in, and there have been accidents. Not the sky is falling from space in terms of nuclear devices in space. So I've been to Russia, and in Russia, they've built nukes in the middle of cities with the same delusion that, they're safe. In fact, the first time I was to Russia, I went to Voronezh, which is not too far from Moscow. And there in the middle of this city, Voronezh, big city, is this nuclear power plant with these huge pipes from the power plant, providing radiation-tinged steam to the very like Stalin-era apartment houses near the nuclear power plant. So, I mean, the history of nuclear power has been a history of false promises and baloney. At one point, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, which preceded the NRC, was a replacement agency of the AEC. Actually, to a large degree, let's throw Long Island in again, Lester Wolf, who just died earlier this year at 104, he was a congressperson from Nassau County. He went to those Atomic Energy Commission hearings. Originally, the AEC handled the Shoreham licensing. And he was just, he was shocked, speaking of shocked, about, it was a kangaroo court. The chairman was the governor of the state of New Mexico, which is like an atomic state, USA. There's all kind of U.S. government nuclear, Los Alamos National Laboratory is in New Mexico, all kind of government nuclear facilities, Sandia National Laboratories. And he led an effort, this is in the 70s, to get rid of the Atomic Energy Commission. It was set up to both regulate and promote nuclear power, a clear conflict of interest.
Yeah.
That's why it said yes to all the nuclear applications that came its way. And it was replaced with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, which frankly is not much better. And to do the promotional aspect, ultimately a U.S. Department of Energy. So things have still not been fixed, but I mean, nuclear power is going nowhere at this point in the United States, mostly because of economics. The cost, there's two nuclear plants being built down south, and each one at this point is projected to cost $13 billion. In fact, Shoreham was the cost, and in fact, in the book Power Crazy, I reprint as a facsimile, the original press release, 1966, put out by Lilco about Shoreham, saying it would be in the $65 to $75 million range. Ultimately, it cost in the $6.5 to $7.5 billion range. Wow. That's why this huge nut that we got to pay to have gotten rid of Shoreham. Now the nuclear plants, twice as much, but in this new two infrastructure bills that have been passed by Congress, the Biden administration has pushed it, and the Republicans, not all, but some of them have gotten on board, so they've passed. These are huge. I mean, we're talking trillions of dollars. And in these infrastructure bills are $50 billion for somehow supporting the continuation of nuclear power in the United States, providing bailouts for nuclear power construction if there's problems and so forth. And the big line now, Louis Strauss, who was the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, in terms of one big lie, used to say that nuclear power could provide electricity too cheap to meter. That was the lie then. And there was been many lies in between, a lot about how they're all so safe, not so safe. They're not safe at all. They're very dangerous. Look at Chernobyl, look at Fukushima, look at Three Mile Island. I mean, every decade, catastrophic accidents somewhere. But beyond all that, we're faced now, I mean, this is the key argument by the nuclear proponents these days. It's necessary to deal with climate change, that a nuclear reactor doesn't emit carbon, doesn't emit greenhouse gases. Now, what they fail to mention is that the nuclear fuel cycle, this is the pushers, the promoters of nuclear power. What they fail to mention is the nuclear fuel cycle is terribly carbon intensive. Mining, milling, particularly fuel enrichment, because you got to get the amount of U-235, uranium-235, from it's 0.7% in nature. You got to bring it up to 4 or 5% in a nuclear power plant. In a bomb like the Hiroshima bomb, the enrichment is 90%. But in any case, enrichment is terribly carbon intensive. And in fact, nuclear plants themselves do emit carbon, radioactive carbon, carbon-14. They're no substitute whatsoever for what's really needed here, safe, clean, green energy. And the technology for safe, green, clean energy is here today, led by solar, wind, geothermal, tidal power, wave power. I mean, there's a long list. I mean, if anybody's interested in how the world can be powered by safe, green energy, the expert that I would suggest, just Google his name, Mark Jacobson, J-A-C-O-B-S-O-N. Right. A professor, a researcher at Stanford University of California. And he's written and written about how the world, how this country can be easily powered by leading with solar and wind. And you could go down the list. No need for nuclear power, never was a need. The reason the Atomic Energy Commission originally wanted to build nuclear power plants, and another book I've written on this issue is Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, is that the Atomic Energy Commission replaced the Manhattan Project in 1946. The Manhattan Project, for listeners who aren't aware, was the name for the crash program during World War II to build nuclear weapons. And when the Manhattan Project developed ways, there's two fuels for an atomic bomb. One is uranium, as I mentioned before, highly enriched, 90%. And then what the Manhattan Project developed was this other source of a fuel for a nuclear weapon, and that's plutonium. Plutonium, considered the most toxic radioactive substance that exists. The Nagasaki bomb was based on plutonium, and virtually all atomic bombs since plutonium. The hydrogen bomb has a plutonium trigger, but it's a different system. It's a fusion system. And how the Manhattan Project got to know about plutonium is, well, there was laboratory work and stuff, but then it set up some plutonium production reactors up at Hanford in the state of Washington to do fission and to produce through the use, I don't want to get too technical here, but what the Manhattan Project was concerned about was, would there be enough high-grade, so-called high-grade uranium ore for nuclear weapons? I mean, even today, that's an issue, whether there's enough high-grade, relatively high-grade uranium ore for nuclear power plants. So the alternative was the development of plutonium. And I say, again, I don't want to be too technical, but 0.7% of naturally occurring uranium is uranium-235. That's fissile, that'll split. But 99.3% is uranium-238. That doesn't split. But what they found out during the Manhattan Project is uranium-238 is placed in proximity of fission. It'll pick up a neutron and transform itself to plutonium-239. And that's fissile, that'll split. And they created these production reactors in what's now called the Hanford Nuclear Reservation along the Columbia River, which it has polluted beyond belief in the state of Washington. They placed uranium-238 in these reactors in the proximity of fission, turned into plutonium. And then there comes the Nagasaki bomb, fueled by plutonium, and so forth and so on. The original notion of the Atomic Energy Commission for nuclear power plants is that they would serve, like those Hanford reactors serve, to produce plutonium for weapons. And as a side benefit also generate electricity, because it's a very hot process. You could use the heat to turn a turbine and generate electricity. But that was the original reason. And in fact, in Russia, and again, I've been in Russia and I've dealt with proponents of nuclear in Russia as well as opponents. I've spoken at forums in Russia and some rather big events. In Russia, they've been using their nuclear power plants to produce necessary fuel, if you consider this necessary, for nuclear weaponry. So the line, there's no real peaceful atom and atom for war. It's two sides of the same coin. That's why, let me jump to it right away. Any country that develops a way to produce electricity through nuclear has a reactor, period. To create electricity, just has a nuclear reactor, develops the material, the plutonium, and trained personnel to produce nuclear weapons. I mean, India got the bomb in 1974. The Canadians provided India with a CANDU reactor. We, under our Atoms for Peace program, the U.S. talking about a lie, provided them with other assistance and other material and personal help. And through this Atoms for Peace myth, India had got the bomb. And then it's because India got the bomb, Pakistan had the bomb. So a presentation I have given all over is that if we're to avoid nuclear destruction, and we've just by the skin of our teeth avoided it so far, I mean, other than Nagasaki and Hiroshima, no nuclear weapon has been dropped yet. And it's come close. The Cuban Missile Crisis could have ended in a nuclear exchange between us and the Soviet Union. we've come very close, and there have been accidents. Really, we have to have a nuclear-free planet. In fact, at the United Nations, there's a designation given to various parts of the planet which are designated nuclear-free zones. But they're just talking about nuclear weaponry. The Pacific, Antarctica, elsewhere. In fact, in my judgment, if your grandchildren and their grandchildren are going to make it, because, I mean, the Bulletin for Atomic Scientists, just at the beginning of this year, they have a doomsday clock.
Right.
Reduce the number of, we're talking minutes before doomsday. We need to have a world where there's no nuclear weaponry. Like after World War I, nuclear chemical warfare was abolished. It was numbers of treaties after the use of mustard gas and so forth in World War I. The world realized that this was a horrific weapon and had to be outlawed. And it hasn't been perfect, but the treaties that were put into force in the 20s to prohibit, to bar the use of nuclear, of chemical weapons, have more or less held, not totally, but we got to do the same thing with nuclear. We must, in my view, outlaw nuclear weaponry as being even more horrific than chemical weapons. And also at the same time, outlaw nuclear technology. I mean, people will say you can't put the genie back in the bottle. They put the chemical weapons genie back in the bottle. Not totally, but almost. After the horrors of World War I, let's not have a nuclear war, because this is an apocalyptic, unbelievable, because the kind of bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki are, and I hate to say peanut size, but compared to the multi-warhead missiles on submarines ready to be dropped by bombers sitting in silos, both here and in Russia. China is developing even more, supposedly, this has just came out a few months ago, more missile silos. If we're going to have a world which is livable, which has a future, we got to put this horrible, horrible specter of nuclear technology back into the bottle. And we can, like we did with chemical warfare.
And you've mentioned so many things here, but one of the things you mentioned was that carbon 14 that comes from carbon-free nuclear plants, that has a half-life of approximately 5,700 years. And its hazardous life is 10 to 20 times of its half-life. So that means that the harmful exposure to man-made carbon 14 in the air, water, and food can last for hundreds of generations. So the difference between nuclear waste and other kinds of pollution is that these nuclear waste materials are going to be around and continue to be dangerous for a long time after the United States is no longer the United States. Think about that.
Yeah. And consider plutonium. I mentioned plutonium-239, which is actually built up as a waste product in a nuclear power plant, you know, large amounts of it, hundreds right. of pounds a year and so forth. That has plutonium-239. It takes on a neutron from uranium-238, becomes plutonium-239. That has a half-life of 24,300 years. So multiply that by 10 or 20. If you're sort of conservative, you go to 20, which you really should go to. 10 is...
Sure.
But that has a hazardous lifetime of between, I mean, everybody has to hold their breath, between 250,000 and 500,000 years.
Yep.
That's a very, very long time. The person who kind of in the later edition of my book, Cover Up What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, I quote a long speech given by Hyman Rickover, Admiral Hyman Rickover. He's considered the father of the nuclear navy. And in fact, he was in charge of the construction of the first nuclear power plant in the U.S. in Shippingport in Pennsylvania. And he was all into nuclear power, but ultimately he had an epiphany. And when he gave his farewell speech to Congress in 1982, and you can read it in my book or just Google it. Brickover speaks about how billions of years ago, there was so much naturally occurring radiation on Earth and life couldn't exist. And only when these naturally occurring radioactive poisons went through their half-lives, went through their hazardous lifetimes, could life begin in billions of years ago. And then Rickover, now this is not Greenpeace, this is Rickover saying, we must outlaw nuclear reactors because, again, it's Rickover, this is where, this is how the human race is going to destroy itself. Mm. Nuclear plants do produce, and it's not just the plutonium as a waste product, it's the cesium and it's the strontium and it's on and on. It's hundreds of waste, nuclear waste, radioactive waste products. Some will be around, you know, as you were mentioning with carbon 14, millennia after millennia. What these are really are hazardous twins of safe and stable elements in nature. And the body can't distinguish between, well, for example, radioactive iodine is a real problem if there's a nuclear plant accident because it gets into the thyroid and causes thyroid cancer. Many places in the world, they dispense potassium iodide pills for people to take if there was a nuclear plant accident to block the radioactive iodine. There's a debate about how effective that's going to be. And then there's meanwhile, hundreds of other what's called fission products. But these fission products, these radioactive poisons are really what Rickover was talking about billions of years ago, precluding life. So that's the stakes here. I mean, this is a life and death challenge. And well, now there's more than 400 nuclear plants in the world. Richard Nixon said there'd be 1,000 nuclear power plants in the US around, well, actually 2000, in the year 2000, he said. Now there's 99. They've been closing down one after another. But still, you don't need, look what happened to Fukushima, look what happened to Japan because of Fukushima. Just consider what's happened to the Ukraine because of Chernobyl. Monstrous accidents as a result. And again, this trip is unnecessary. I mean, certain trips, we're in Long Island, we got to go on the Long Island Expressway to get most anywhere. I mean, that's the only highway, but there's all other kind of energy highways. In fact, an excellent report just done on Long Island is Long Island Solar Roadmap. It was a report issue spearheaded by the Nature Conservancy and Defenders of Wildlife and others involved, Sierra Club and so forth. And here's the bottom line, how solar power has the potential to generate more electricity than Long Island uses each year. And in every place in the country, every place in the world, there's a mix. Some countries would use perhaps solar and tidal and geothermal and wind in different amounts and a different mix. But in fact, as Mark Jacobson says, everywhere in the world and the entire planet, there's enough green, clean, safe energy sources, energy we can live with, to provide all the power any place, anywhere needs.
Yeah, and globally, if you look at the amount of power generated by wind and solar versus nuclear, since the year 2000, you'd see that in the year 2000, nuclear was way above wind and solar. Wind and solar weren't a tiny fraction of what nuclear was creating. However, since that time, wind and solar have actually overtaken nuclear generation. So the trend is in place. And also, if we look at the costs, the cost of renewable energy has been falling like crazy. Mm-hmm. Onshore wind has fallen by 71% between 2009 and 2020. Utility scale solar has fallen by 90% in the same period. And in that same period, new nuclear costs rose 26%. But nuclear costs are hard to put your finger on because there are always the cost overruns. You don't build a nuclear plant without cost overruns. And private capital does not go toward nuclear plants because they are so expensive. On the positive side, things are changing and we're seeing it in front of our eyes.
I mean, in fact, not just in front of our eyes. I'm sitting here above my head in this little house that my wife and I live in Sag Harbor. It's an old salt box house, 100 years old, are 38 solar panels and two thermal panels. So those 38 photovoltaic panels, I mean, the LIPA meter out back here, it goes backwards all the time because we're generating more electricity than we need here in the house. As to thermal, I mean, you turn on the shower, that hot water, most of it is coming from, if not all of it on certain days, from those two thermal panels. Even during March and November, when it's kind of coldish outside, because it's like leaving your car with the windows up in terms of using thermal panels. It's solar again, but it heats water, which then provides that hot water in the shower, or the base of the house is oil hot water. So the hot water now is an oil system down in the basement, but that's off most of the time because the hot water is coming down from the
roof. It's your backup system at this point.
Yeah.
And in my house, I too have all the solar panels, and I've got a geothermal heating and cooling. My heating and cooling comes from geothermal. The geothermal is run by the solar, the electricity, and everything that powered in this house comes from the solar. So your house and my house are examples of what is possible, not 50 years from now, but right now. And of course, we need leadership to usher this in and to let the world know that this is possible. And there are people like you and I who are living without electricity bills. And we save every single year that we live in our homes.
This is Bob DiBenedetto on WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook with the Healthy Planet radio program. We're speaking to longtime investigative reporter, professor of journalism, and author of six books, Carl Grossman, about nuclear power.
Before we run out of time, Bob, let me jump to like what you're just saying now, how this is a political issue, not a technological issue anymore. The technology is all here. And another area that we have to act in, and again, before we run out of time, let me talk about nukes in space.
Exactly right.
Because I got into this, this goes back to the 80s. In 85, I read about, in a Department of Energy newsletter, two shuttles, space shuttles, which would have been sent up into space in 86 with plutonium fuel space probes aboard. And then the Department of Energy Insider was the title of the publication, said that DOE and NASA and various national nuclear laboratories had looked at Los Alamos, Oak Ridge, had looked into the possibility of accidents. So I filed a Freedom of Information Act request with NASA and DOE and those labs, saying, well, what would occur if there'd be an explosion on launch, if the shuttle and one of the shuttles was to be the Challenger, blew up in the lower atmosphere, the upper, and so forth. It took me months to get information. And finally, the end of 85, I got to live in Sag Harbor under Freedom of Information Act, got a box of documents from DOE and NASA saying that, well, we're not too concerned because the likelihood of a catastrophic shuttle accident was 1 in 100,000. Well, then just a few weeks later, I was on my way to work. I teach professor of journalism at SUNY Old Westbury. I was to teach my first investigative reporting class of January 28th, 1986. And I hear on the car radio that the Challenger blew up. And all I was thinking is the next mission in May, it was to have this payload aboard of all this plutonium. I stopped off at a PC Richards store and I saw that terrible, iconic video of the Challenger blowing up, Krista McAuliffe's parents in the bleachers down at the Cape crying, their daughter killed in this accident. And I called The Nation magazine, this is before cell phones, saying that, do you folks know that the next mission of the Challenger was to be a nuclear mission? And they said, no, and they could you write an editorial about it? So I did. It was titled The Lethal Shuttle. It was front page of The Nation magazine. And that started me off on the issue of the use of nuclear in space, where there have been, like, this is not the sky is falling. There have been accidents. For example, in 64, a U.S. satellite, originally the satellites, our U.S. satellites were fueled with plutonium, came crashing down. It was the Snap 9A. Disintegrated when it hit the atmosphere, plutonium spread all over the planet. pounds of plutonium. Dr. John Goffman, University of California at Berkeley, also involved in the isolation of plutonium during the Manhattan Project, PhD and an MD, knew about plutonium quite well. He connected and medical issues as a result of radioactivity. He connected the SNAP-9A accident with a spike in lung cancer. If a millionth of a gram of plutonium gets into one's lung, lung cancer, like all the
time. A millionth of a gram,
microscopic. That's why it's considered the most toxic radioactive substance. And I got on that issue, and I've been on that issue ever since. And to jump ahead to what's happening now, and again, this is the political aspect of it. We can do things. We can put solar on our roofs, but how are we going to stop these mad people from using plutonium, using nuclear material, using radioactive processes, and affecting us? I mean, right now, well, in terms of those odds, 1 in 100,000. In a matter of months, NASA and DOE changed the odds of a catastrophic shuttle accident to 1 in 76. Hmm. It was realistic. I mean, there was 2 catastrophic accidents, the shuttle and the Columbia, out of 150 shots. But now NASA and DOE, they're moving ahead with the support of the Biden administration, with the enormous support of the Trump administration, to use nuclear in space. They bring reactors up to the moon to provide power to moon colonies. They want to have nuclear propelled rockets to get astronauts quicker to Mars and so forth. But what would occur if, in fact, like happened with Challenger, one of the rockets that would be carrying up, some of these Mars rovers have plutonium as their fuel. Hmm. They don't have to have them. There's been Mars rovers that use solar. Again, these vested interests, the manufacturers behind this nuclear hardware, these national nuclear laboratories, which come out of the Manhattan Project. In fact, Brookhaven Lab really comes out of the Manhattan Project. When the Manhattan Project was over, they figured, well, we got to have one laboratory that will pursue civilian uses of nuclear technology. We can make more weapons, but I mean, you can't sell an atom bomb or a hydrogen bomb to, I mean, even the French or the English. What can we do with nuclear to keep our jobs? GE and Westinghouse were big contractors to keep our contract. So on this former Army base in Suffolk County, Camp Upton, they set up Brookhaven National Laboratory to push nuclear power. But in any case, as Helen Caldicott said, this was at a protest against a nuclear plant up in New Hampshire. And she said, that I quote her in my book, Cover Up, What You're Not Supposed to Know About Nuclear Power, where in the hands of lunatics and at the crossroads of time. And in terms of pushing nuclear, it truly is lunacy, whether it's on the Earth or to use it on space devices. Getting back to an accident on launch, 1 out of 100 rockets on launch undergo major malfunctions, usually blowing up. So what if these plutonium-powered Mars rovers that have been sent up in recent years were on a rocket that would blow up on launch.
And there are alternatives, Garland.
Oh,
solar
and
is a good alternative to colonizing the moon, Mars.
And in fact, listeners should go to my piece. It's on Counterpunch. This is last year, the big push for nukes in space. And here I quote Universe Today, which is not an environmental magazine at all. Headline, solar power is best for Mars colonies. Here's Discover magazine also, how to harvest terawatts of solar power on the moon. And in terms of moving spacecraft, you don't need reactors, which are being pushed right now by the Department of Energy and the manufacturers of these space nuclear reactors. Here is an article in New Scientist. Also not exactly, which I quote in my piece on Counterpunch, the big push for nukes in space. The link's there, you can go see the article. This article in New Scientist talks about the new age of sail, Subhead, we're on the cusp of a new type of space travel that can take us to places no rocket could ever visit. And it begins talking about astronomer Johann Kepler in the 17th century, seeing how comets always had their tails pointed away from the sun, no matter which direction they were traveling. And it meant only one thing: the comet tails were being blown from the sun. And the article goes on about the sun produces a wind in space and it can be harnessed. And in, the Japanese have, in fact, just a few years ago, sent off a space probe with solar sails. Mylar, now there's been advances on that. And we somehow, NASA decided to launch, this is a few years ago, the Juno spacecraft. Photovoltaic panels, no plutonium.
And there we go.
All the way to Jupiter. So again, nukes on Earth, nukes in space. We have to stand up. We got to get rid of them and push hard for safe, clean, green energy, energy we can live with.
And yet the fascination with him for quote unquote clean energy, when we have plenty of actual clean energy sources, and for space
continues. And why that continues is a whole other topic. So is there anything else you'd like to add to the wealth of information you've already provided, Carl?
People should get active. Remember the old motto was active today or radioactive tomorrow. Organizations that I would suggest, well, Beyond Nuclear, an excellent organization, is based in Tacoma Park in Maryland. The Nuclear Information and Resource Service, excellent. Greenpeace, excellent. Organize, get involved in groups, also individually, write letters, learn about all this stuff. I do a TV series of programs. It's just go to envirovideo.com, envirovideo.com, and you can watch them for free. In fact, one I did about 8 months ago, Alec Baldwin is featured in it. The hoax that nuclear power is green is the title. Watch it, learn about this issue, and act on it.
Great. Carl Grossman, thank you for being with us, and thank you for all your decades of work. Again, all of us are indebted to you for speaking your voice and for remaining active. Thank you.
A pleasure.
We've been talking to longtime investigative reporter, professor of journalism, and author of 6 books, Carl Grossman, about nuclear power. You can find out more about Carl at www.carlgrossman.com. That's Carl with a K, K-A-R-L, Grossman.com. Also go to www.envirovideo.com, envirovideo.com, and I've actually appeared on that program.
And our nonprofit organization, Healthy Planet, has hosted Carl at events throughout the years. And I've appeared with Carl at other events where we've both been speakers. So I've been bumping into Carl for many years. This discussion about nuclear power is really needed at this point in time. The reality of climate change has unfortunately become more and more visible in our world, despite decades of warnings from the best climate scientists on the planet. Immense wildfires, historical storms, relentless drought, rising sea levels, and more are now the subject of almost daily news reports. In fact, it's getting so severe that even those who have in the past flat out denied the existence of human-related climate change and then moved to the standard line of, well, I'm not a scientist, are now saying, well, of course the climate's changing. The question is, are we going to ruin our economy to stop it? And they'd have a really good point there if creating jobs, saving money, and saving tens of thousands of lives each year was their definition of ruining the economy. Basically, those who, for one reason or another, see it in their best interest to still deny the truth of climate change are shifting and wriggling and crafting their words in any way they can to still misportray the issue, given the undeniable reality that's starting to manifest outside of our windows and on our screens. But even in the face of that constant barrage of misinformation from the naysayers, the market, simple economics, and common sense has kicked in to make our vision for a clean energy world not only desirable for the stability of our society, human health, and the environment, but also for its positive impact on our wallets.
It bears repeating that about 90% of all new electricity generation installed worldwide in the year 2020 came from wind and solar. And projections from the International Energy Agency say that going forward in this decade, those renewables will make up 95% of new electricity generation. And partly as a result of the scientific community begging us to move forward on clean energy for decades, governments started to give some subsidies to the wind and solar industries that have been wild successes. And while the amount was not nearly as much as has been given to the fossil fuel industries, it helped clean energy get a foothold. And that's what government subsidies are supposed to do, to promote what's good for the American public. And now these industries are able to survive on their own. A subsidy that supports an industry that poses now unnecessary dangers to the public, now and for millennia to come, like nuclear energy or fossil fuels that are responsible for hundreds of thousands of illnesses and deaths in this country each year, is a subsidy that is misspent. Especially now that we have clean energy alternatives that are cheaper than the forms of energy that kill us. Simple. Fortunately, things are going our way. And by our, I mean those of us who breathe and value clean air and a stable environment. With all that, proponents of expensive and dangerous nuclear power still portray it as a needed and viable solution going forward. That shiny new technology that's just going to solve all of our problems. Nuclear energy is a lot of things. One of them is not clean. One of them is not sustainable and safe. And here's a little exercise you can do that might help you understand the risk that's involved. Pull out your homeowner's insurance and look under exclusions. It'll say something like this. We do not provide coverage for damages, defense costs, or any other cost or expense fee for... And then look for something called nuclear hazard. For personal injury or property damage caused directly or indirectly by nuclear hazard. And I'm reading from a home insurance policy. Nuclear hazard means any nuclear reaction, radiation, or radioactive contamination. All whether controlled or uncontrolled, or however caused. We do not cover subsequent loss due to fire resulting from a nuclear hazard, unless another exclusion applies. They don't put those on our policies for nothing. On that note, we'll close this show. This is Bob DiBenedetto on The Healthy Planet on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. I'll be with you again at this same time next week and every month thereafter at 6 p.m. on the first two Fridays of the month. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and The Healthy Planet shows every week at this time with great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. That's every week, Fridays at 6 p.m. For more info on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you're interested in having me do a virtual presentation to your school or group, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org or email us to join our mailing list at info@healthyplanetusa.org. Also, like our Facebook page, which is at Healthy Planet USA. Until next time, stay strong, relax, make your voice heard in this world by continuing to speak for what's right. Be kind to those around you, including our amazing four-legged friends, and enjoy this beautiful world that we all share.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.